Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast. We're podcast movie review, do we?
Well done.
My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a senior staff writer over at Slash Film. You can call me Whitney if you like. Or hey, you. Or hey, down in front.
Yeah, down in front is... You actually don't usually sit in the front. You usually like to sit in the back of the theater and towards the like audience right.
Yeah.
House right, I guess is what that would
I
be.
Guess I like to sit. Yeah, I like to sit sort of in the back right corner of the theater because that's the proper place to sit.
Is it really? Is it really?
It is.
I was yes. Unaware. Okay, well, good to know. I've
never understood the people who wanted to sit like up front or get like in the first third of the theater. It's like that there should be no seats there. You shouldn't sit that close to the screen. It should be back where you can see the entire mise en scène.
I like looking up at the theater, like at the screen, you know, like sort of like, you know, sort of like it gives you a sense of like awe and wonder, like you're looking up at Godzilla, you know.
Rather than looking down
on Godzilla. For me, I like that. I like that effect. That kind of it adds grandeur to anything. But
I do that, and first of all, I get a little just headachey and cross-eyed just because there's too much image in my field of vision. And if I'm sitting too close, everything looks like distorted, and I can't tell what's going on. So I have to sit in the back so I can see everything. And I know I'm correct. That's all I'm going to say.
I respect that. This week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing some movies. We got a little catching up to do. We're reviewing Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, which is different from the Frozen Empire, although this empire is also frozen. The First Omen, which is, I think, like the fifth omen, but okay.
Sixth omen, I believe. Well, there was also two TV shows.
Oh, you're right. Okay, well, many an omen, really. Monkey Man, the new action movie starring and directed by Dev Patel. And The People's Joker. And those are the movies we'll be reviewing on the podcast that we do.
We're catching up. We skipped over a week just because it's yet another week where we're busy and we want to be sure to give you like a full episode and not just we saw a movie this week. We're catching up.
The real tricky thing was if we had recorded an episode last week, and we're like a day late here right now, but like we recorded an episode last week, we would have only done an episode about the new Godzilla movie, but we're doing a Godzilla podcast, and in like two and a half months, we're going to do a whole episode about that Godzilla movie anyway, and it felt a little redundant, so we figured we should wait.
But
let's get into it. Let's talk about, there's a new Godzilla movie in theaters, and obviously we'll go into great detail on Thank Godzilla It's Friday when we give it its own episode. But the latest film is Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. And I had a long conversation with some people who had done the junket for this movie.
Okay.
And when you're doing
reporters or publicists,
interviewers, and people do the interview bits. I don't. And there was some concern over how, in God's name, you're supposed to pronounce this title. Is it Godzilla X Kong? Is it Godzilla and Kong? Godzilla times Kong? Godzilla plus Kong? Godzilla kills Kong? Godzilla kiss Kong? Kisses and hugs? And apparently, the publicist said, it's just supposed to be Godzilla Kong. No.
Well,
you put an X
no,
in there.
No, that's... It's I think you pronounce the X, but you don't have to. You can say Godzilla Kong, because it's meant to denote a collaboration. Like you've seen maybe two products that are collaborating, you know, Dr. Pepper and Peeps. It would be Dr. Pepper X Peeps on the package.
No, it wouldn't.
For instance, when two artists collaborate on a track, they'll say, you know, the two artists with an X in between. That's common. It's common slang.
I actually don't see that. No, I just know that when Baz Luhrmann did William Shakespeare's Romeo X Juliet.
It was Romeo plus Juliet.
Exactly my point. You take the X and you turn it over a little bit, and then it makes sense, because then it's a plus sign. The X is not a thing. But in any case,
you can call it Godzilla Kong, and I've been saying Godzilla X Kong because that sounds better to me. But yeah, you can say Godzilla Kong.
You could also
look around on collaborations like between products and artists, and you'll see that X everywhere. It's pretty common.
I will not, because I won't bother looking it up. I will say this: I do believe that it would be so cool, since Godzilla over the course of this movie kind of gets like leveled up as a monster. That's kind of a plot point, and it happens early enough. It's not a spoiler, and you see it in the trailer. What if it's Godzillax Kong? And like now Godzilla's all buff, it's Godzillax.
No, because I mean, if we're going by old school Toho rules, when you upgrade a monster, it's not the same monster anymore.
That's not true. Mothra upgrades itself constantly.
Yeah, but they give each Mothra a new name, and technically it's like branded as a separate monster.
No, but like Mothra
Leo, for instance.
But the Mothra larva goes to Mothra though.
And those are both called Mothra, but one is Mothra Larva and one is Mothra Moth.
And I think we've been looking at Godzilla Larva, and now it's the Godzilla's coming to his own.
It's Godzilla X Kong. The point is, it's not versus anymore. That's they are now collaborating. So it's Godzilla Kong, the new empire. This is the second Godzilla film from Adam Wingard, and I think Adam Wingard cracked the code on the MonsterVerse. We talked about this on our Godzilla podcast, but when Gareth Edwards made his Godzilla film in 2014, a big American production, it was very somber, and they tried to give it kind of a grit, even though the movie wasn't really about much of anything, and it wasn't... We came to the conclusion that it wasn't that great. And then they tried to sort of make it a lot more salacious right away by throwing in a bunch of other monsters. First of all, there was Kong Skull Island, so we introduced King Kong.
And even that was kind of
serious.
That was intense. They were like, hey, what if Kong but Apocalypse Now? And I'm like,
yeah.
You don't have nearly as much to say as Apocalypse Now does, but you go ahead and recapture those vibes, I guess.
And then they made Godzilla King of the Monsters, which brought a bunch of monsters in, but they still went for that kind of somber, gritty realism in a Godzilla movie, even though we have monsters like King Ghidorah and Mothra in that one. And it wasn't until Godzilla versus Kong that the filmmakers decided to, you know, kind of roll with the fact that this is kind of ridiculous. And they made, you know, portals to the middle of the earth and sort of this subterranean monster land. And then, of course, they had salvaged King Ghidorah's skull and used it to activate Mechagodzilla, who Kong and Godzilla team up to fight at the end, and they knock over a bunch of buildings. Fun! More fun now. And that kind of harkened back to a lot of the Ishiro Honda movies, where, you know, monsters would team up, stuff like Invasion of Astro Monster. Now we're back with Godzilla Kong, the New Empire, Godzilla X Kong. It's Adam Wingard again. And he's just rolling forward with that, and I think he's really drawing from the 70s Godzilla movies.
Oh, like, yeah.
The more ridiculous ones directed by Jun Fukuda.
Yeah, the ones that were very kid-friendly. Like, we're not about anything anymore. That day has passed. We're here to see a bunch of monsters do ridiculous stuff and fight each other, and occasionally it's going to be super silly, and you love it, so just enjoy. And honestly, yeah. Yeah, I guess I give Gareth Edwards some credit for, at the very least, attempting within the Hollywood studio system to evoke something serious. Like, it feels very clear he was trying to be one of the post 9/11, very serious, destructive blockbusters. Yeah. We'd already had, like, the Avengers, which was, if you want to look at the way that, like, Hollywood processed 9/11, because 9/11 was obviously a horrible, terrifying tragedy, and it was extremely, like, just huge. Like, people said it felt like a movie, right? In the wake of that, movies with that level of sort of citywide destruction were considered inappropriate or gauche, or at the very least too soon. And we got less of them. And when we got them, they tended to be a little bit more intense. But I think when Avengers came around, that was like, hey, what if a horrible, like, destructive tragedy happened in New York, but we had a whole bunch of costume crime fighters to protect us?
Yeah.
And I think, I don't want to give it too much credit, but I do think that movie helped this kind of giant destruction sort of extravaganza be socially acceptable and fun again. Like, you could enjoy it a little bit as an escape. And I think Godzilla was trying to go back to before that, and I think eventually the legendary movies realized, no, everyone wants the destruction. Everyone wants giant monsters fighting. Everyone wants, like, a monster who, like, throws a giant chain around a building and rips half the building off and then uses that as a morning star. Like, that's where we're at here. That's what the legendary... We're not good at being about things. We're here to be silly. And I think Godzilla X Kong, even more so... I know a lot of people love Godzilla versus Kong, and I like it fine. But I still feel like it was trying, like, too hard to be a real movie. Like, there's just too many subplots and characters running around. Like, just overcomplicating it to an almost Transformers movie degree. And in Godzilla...
Is Godzilla versus Kong you're talking
Godzilla
about?
Godzilla versus Kong. Because you have all that stuff with, like, right, hey, what if a conspiracy theorist was right about everything? And we got to bring Millie Bobby Brown back, even though she has literally nothing to do this time. And also, there's this whole corrupt thing. Like, there's just too much. There's too much of a muchness to it. And I feel like with Godzilla X Kong, it is refreshingly direct for this kind of a blockbuster. The world has been divided. The surface is ruled by Godzilla. The undersea kingdom, the Hollow Earth, is ruled by King Kong. And if they ever break into each other's territory, they fight fine.
And Kong has a, like, a dad bod and a gray beard now.
Yeah.
He's getting a little older.
He's got my beard, which I kind of like. Like, he styles it the way I do. And I thought that was kind of, which is to say, not really. So King Kong is also searching Hollow Earth for more giant apes, because he's the only one. And he finds them, but they're assholes. And he has to fight them, and they're trying to crawl their way back up to the surface and take over the world and start a whole new ape empire. And that's kind of it. There's really not much more to it than that. And I'm fine with that simplicity. And because it's straightforward, they could have done the thing where it's like there aren't enough monster fights, but they spread them out throughout the whole movie. It's paced very well. I was entertained this entire time.
I mean, this movie's super frantic, and it has, you know, just a lot of fantasy conceits that you just have to accept. We live in a monster world, and they invent new rules kind of on the fly. Oh, and we've discovered a psychic wave that's coming from somewhere in the Earth, and it's activating Godzilla, and we don't know why or what that is. Like, they explain what it is later on, but what? Like, where did that stuff come from?
Yeah.
don't think about physics or why there's sunlight in Hollow Earth or any of that. In fact, there's a scene in this movie where there's a zero gravity sequence.
Oh, God. It's so silly.
And the monsters lose gravity and start fighting in this zero gravity environment. There's no up and there's no down. It's just a lot of swirling monster shapes as they wail on each other and, you know, use their weapons and shoot their atomic breath at each other. It's inane, but it's inane in a way I appreciate. Adam Wingard really knows how to tap into that kind of sensationalist little kid mindset, and that's all he's interested in doing. Mm. What is this movie about? Don't think about it.
King Adam Kong gets a power glove. That's what it's about. That's why we're
King
here
Kong,
today.
Yeah, like it's a little kid. It's no more basic than no more complicated than that.
Yeah, no.
I did read. I don't like to read reviews until I've written mine, and actually wrote my review, so I can quote this one. Walter Chaw wrote a review of Godzilla X Kong, and Walter Chaw gave it 0 stars.
Oh yeah.
And when Walter Chaw hates something, he really hates something. He's a great author. You should read
it. And
him.
He has a reason. But, yeah.
Yeah, always has a really great reason. He and I rarely see eye to eye, but I have nothing but respect for the guy.
Same.
And he pointed out that let's go back to what Godzilla and Kong like first represented. You know, how it's been a long time since Godzilla was a symbol for nuclear devastation, but it hasn't been so long since Godzilla was sort of reflected in Japanese national pride. And Godzilla Minus One, it was sort of like the scar of the war that had to be defeated in order to heal. But in other movies, Godzilla was kind of a deliberately created creature used to defend Japan. With all of that sort of mixed up, what are we getting in Godzilla X Kong? Godzilla is not Japanese. Godzilla is just this sort of force of destruction.
He spends all his time in Rome, actually. He curls up inside the Colosseum to nap, and that's cute, by the way.
That's adorable. Yeah. And of course, you know, Kong was, and this is a pretty common interpretation, it was even said in the movie Inglourious Basterds, how Kong represents slavery.
Yeah.
You know, the slaves that Americans kidnapped from Africa.
Yeah.
And that was the central symbol of Kong. And now we have these two guys putting on power gloves and knocking over the pyramids. Are we going to pause for a minute and note that they knocked over the fucking pyramids? No. Don't stop and think about that.
That's not why
that
we're here.
That would be a pretty terrible thing if that actually happened. But no, this is just about shooting lasers and slamming action figures together. Look, and you know what? I'm okay with that.
The pyramids are just... Here's the deal. The pyramids are destroyed in this movie, but they're destroyed... I don't want to say like for a reason. That makes it sound like there's a really thank God, right? Like no, it's just like they don't want him to. Like Kong is actually trying to accomplish a goal in that scene. In fact, that whole scene, I know this was intentional. I know someone did this on purpose. That scene where they're fighting at the pyramids, because it's the scene later in the movie where Kong and Godzilla are going to fight, and it's just before they team up. It's that scene in the comic book where the two superheroes meet for the first time, they have to fight, and then they team up to fight the common bad guy. It's in every comic book movie. We want it. It's fine. That scene is the scene from Batman v Superman, where Superman goes to Batman and says, "Hey, dude, wait up a second. We got to team up." And Batman just won't stop wailing on him. That King Kong is Superman. Godzilla is Batman, and I swear to God, the climax of both scenes, one is we all know what it is, and the other one is clearly a parody of it. It's genius. It is so goddamn funny. I laughed so hard. It's really, really, really funny. One thing I like about this movie, and I agree with you, it's not about anything. We've abandoned that. And honestly, some of the late Toho era movies really weren't about anything either. And I think that's also part of the legend now.
Yeah.
And it's good that we have both. If we only had vapid Godzilla, I think it would get real old real fast. But we just had Godzilla Minus One. That movie is genius. This is the cherry on top. This is the ice cream sundae at the end of after you have a salad. But one thing I really like about this movie, and I think there really aren't a lot of other giant monster movies and these franchises that have this, that can say this, the monsters are the leads, not the star of the show, not the reason we're here. They're driving the plot. Kong is a full character. Kong is the protagonist here, and we get to see him solve problems and think and emote and go through a journey. And Godzilla is a bit more of a supporting player, but to a lesser extent, Godzilla does too. And I think they're actually doing a really, really good job of making these versions of these characters distinct entities, unlike the other versions that we've seen before, especially Kong, but still. And yeah, I think a lot goes into that. There's a character, the evil ape, the king of the evil apes, the Scar King.
They call it the Scar King. Scar with a K, I learned.
Oh, really? Okay, well, that's just bad spelling. But the physicality on that monster is so distinct. It is so angular and lanky. And you'd think, oh, well, Kong's got so much meat on him, you know? It's like Mike Tyson fighting, you know, Fred Astaire. Like, how is this even going to go? And yet, it's so convincing. They really did think out the way that these creatures move and express emotion and the way that they would think on camera, so that even like monsters that only show up for a short period of time, there's like this one monster the Scar King has kind of under its thumb that it's using, and like there's a scene later in the movie where it's like all of a sudden it experiences wonder. And I'm like, I'm not feeling anything profound, but I shouldn't be feeling anything right now. And you did it a little bit, and I'm going to give you a lot of credit for that. You made some really fun CGI monster characters who have captivated me in the way that previously mostly only the Suitmation ones did.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm giving credit for that. That's good stuff.
It's true. Even some of the Toho films, like Godzilla is such a force of destruction, it doesn't have much of a personality. In some of the more recent Toho, like Shin Godzilla. Godzilla deliberately doesn't have a personality. Godzilla is just sort of like this...
An animal.
Might even have a brain in that film. It's just this kind of mindless living thing. It's been a while since we've had monsters with this much personality. It helps that they're letting them do a lot of human-like stuff. Early in the movie, King Kong has a toothache.
Yeah.
And has to go to see a human doctor. And of course we have... Dan Stevens doing Ace Ventura cosplay as this kind of rock and roll veterinarian. Yeah.
What if Ace Ventura was Godzilla's veterinarian? And you know what? That's such a great pitch. I'm not going to lie. Whoever came up with that was a genius. And casting Dan Stevens, because here's the deal. Dan Stevens is incredibly funny, but he knows how to not just be funny. He knows how to take a very broadly comedic performance, like that Eurovision movie, where he played this like really over-the-top kind of musical character. Like
a Russian pop star,
But, like, he could have just played that broad, and it would have been fine. He's a character. He's a character in that movie, and here he has even less to work with, but he's not just comic relief. And I feel like there's another era, another version of this, where you know that character would have been played by someone like Dane Cook, and it would have just been some stand-up comic, some funny guy who's just there to be funny, and it's insufferable, doesn't help anybody when we don't like that character, you know?
Yeah, I feel like we had that in this movie, though, because we have Brian Tyree Henry is back.
And he's such a good actor, too.
And he's an excellent actor. Did you see that film he was in, Causeway?
No, I heard that was amazing.
The one with Jennifer Lawrence? He was really, really good in that movie.
Yeah.
He is an excellent actor, and here he's playing this broad... this broad comedic, like, comic relief character, and he's just not funny. I don't think he's funny. I don't think they let him be funny. They let him do that sort of improvisational type of humor, and it never gets a laugh.
He's not allowed to be funny. He's playing the same character he played in Godzilla vs. Kong, and honestly, he didn't have much to do in that one either. He's just kind of there. Here, when you have a movie with this much made-up shit in it, you have to explain it on camera at some point. And unfortunately, all the main characters in this... And usually what you have to do is you have to go out of your way to include someone who wasn't supposed to be there. Uh-huh. And all the other characters are supposed to be there. Rebecca Hall, who, by the way, one of the greatest actors of her generation, you get that paycheck. You've earned that paycheck. You're allowed to get that paycheck.
Have fun.
Good for you. Yeah, seriously, get that paycheck. And honestly, Brian Terry Henry as well. Get that paycheck. But they're all supposed to be there. They're all experts in some way on Kong stuff. And even though Brian Terry Henry is playing like a conspiracy theorist podcaster, he doesn't know what the fuck is going on. And so he's there to have shit explained to him. And that's a thankless role in just about any movie. It is very, very hard to be the character things get explained to and have some other reason to be in the movie. They usually don't.
Yeah.
In a movie like this. And yeah, it's not great writing, but it's efficient, but it's not good. Like, it gets the job done, but it's thankless. And it's for the audience, it's not for any of the characters, and it's, again, get that paycheck, but you did not have anything to work with, and that is unfortunate. But yeah, no, I mean, it's extremely straightforward. There are some fun fight bits in this that I've never seen before. There's a bit where Kong meets the other apes for the very first time. He hasn't seen apes of his type, I guess, since he was a little Kong, or maybe ever, I don't know. And they don't really specify, like, when did his mom die? I don't know. But he meets these other apes for the very first time, and they've got, like, a King Kong version of Minya. Like a little Son of Kong is there.
I think they call him a mini Kong.
Mini Kong. Close enough. They got a mini Kong. It's a little baby Kong. And the mini Kong is working for the bad guys. It's not a good Kong yet. And he like rats him out to the other Kongs. And the other Kong's like, yeah, fuck that guy. Let's get him. And the Kong has to fight his way out of a whole bunch of Kongs. And there's a bit, and he has not teamed up with this kid yet. That will happen later. But there's a bit where he takes this kid who ratted him out, and he picks up Mini Kong, and he uses Mini Kong as a club. And he hits the other Kongs with him. And you know what?
Amazing.
Was it Werner Herzog who said we're starved for new images?
Yes, sir.
I have
felt that cinema has run out of new images.
Apparently not, because I have not seen that one. And that fed me, that fueled me throughout the whole movie. I was like, oh my God, more of this, please.
I haven't seen that since like an Asterix comic, you know,
right?
Where like Obelix would pick somebody up and thwack them.
Bless him. So, okay, I'm glad we're on the same page with this one. We both agree it's silly fun, and we're going to go into a lot more detail in like a month or so when we
get into the Jun Fukuda comparisons and all the rest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we'll go into huge detail on TJIF, but just a damn fun movie. Speaking of franchise films, we have a prequel to one of the bigger horror franchises, although it hasn't been exploited as much as many of the others in a while. It's the prequel to The Omen. Not The Omen remake. They've decanonized that. Oh, that's a joke, isn't it?
Defrocked it. Excommunicated it. It's no longer a part.
That one's not real. This is a proper prequel to the original Richard Donner, Gregory Peck, The Omen. And I, in advance of this movie, I rewatched all the original Omen movies.
Oof, there are some bad ones in there.
You know, it's a hit or miss franchise, and it's mostly mess. Because the original, and it was coming hot off the heels of Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist, these sort of satanic Hollywood thrillers with like way too good a cast. And it's fun. And it's, you know, God knows, it was Jerry Goldsmith that did the score for that, right?
Oscar
for Jerry
Goldsmith.
Which is ridiculous. He did some of the greatest scores ever. But yeah, no, great score, really, really fun, but there's no subtlety to it at all. It's Gregory Peck finds out his son's the Antichrist. What will it take to get Gregory Peck, arguably the greatest movie dad in history, to kill his 5-year-old son? That's what we're there for. But what I'd forgotten about, and what the first two movies in particular really are more than anything else, is that these were kind of the template for the Final Destination movies, because the pattern that repeats over and over again in The Omen and Damien Omen 2, which picks up years later when Damien's like a becoming a teenager, is someone finds out Damien might be the Antichrist, and then basically the devil wills into being some weird confluence of events that leads to them dying in a spectacular over-the-top accident. The most famous example is David Warner's epic beheading in the original, but Meshach Taylor, Hollywood from the Mannequin movies, gets sliced in half in an elevator in the second movie, and it is on par with some of the better Final Destination killings. But that's kind of all those movies have for a while, and then it's just really repetitive. And then there's the third one with Sam Neill where Damien's an adult, and it's like, okay, this is all come to fruition. He knows he's the Antichrist. He's got a plan.
He's in government. He's going to use government. Which, okay, if you're the Antichrist, but you need, like, a massively complicated bureaucracy, like, mm-hmm. you know, a country's government to take over, then you're not... I would say you're not a very good Antichrist.
Yeah, I mean, they say if in the Bible that the Antichrist will come from the world of politics, which, yeah, fair enough, but... Honestly, I was really shocked by how boring that third movie is. Like,
oh yeah, yeah.
It not a lot happens. They mess with their own canon. They have this whole thing. They're the knives of Megiddo or the daggers of Megiddo are the only thing that can kill Damien. But in the original movie, you have to use like all five of them, and you have to use them in church. And here they just hand one out to every priest they can find and say, "Hey, kill him if you find him." And then it's just, and then it becomes the whole, like, there's the whole thing of him, like, plotting to overtake the world, and that's nonsense. The real joy in that movie is watching a bunch of priests try to kill Sam Neill and fail as spectacularly as, like, Michael Palin in The Fish Called Wanda. Like, every time, it's like, they just bring hell upon themselves. Yeah, just brings hell upon themselves every time they try, and... It's almost funny, but man, that is... You were building to that? Ugh. And then there was the TV movie.
They just said it was the final conflict. They didn't say it was it was the good conflict.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, then there was a TV movie in which a little girl who may or may not be Damien's child with somebody... they're kind of nonspecific about that. Gets adopted by a suburban family, and we're just kind of doing this again. There's one good part in that movie, though, and it's Michael Lerner. Michael Lerner plays the private detective who's investigating where this adopted kid came from, and he's just good in everything. But his death scene, and it's like a TV, like a network TV movie, so it can't be too gory. His death scene is okay. The lead up to the death scene is hilarious because he's realizing that, like, okay, things are conspiring against me. I'm on the run. Supernatural is happening. And you know that wonderful Jerry Goldsmith, like, choral score?
Yeah, Ave Satani, it's called.
Ave Satani. Yeah. They actually have a bunch of, like, people just show up in an alleyway singing that to him.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious.
It's like a dream so sequence, absurd. But yeah, it's like now it's canonical, which is weird.
Like, imagine, if you will, that, like, in, like, Star Wars Episode 9, when, like, Rey was fighting, like, Kylo Ren, and they're, like, fighting on the bones of the Death Star, they, like, turned a corner, and a couple of Sith Lords just started, like screaming Duel of the Fates at them. It's sort of like, okay, well, are we meta now? What are we doing? It's so ridiculous. That's not a good movie, but frankly, most of them aren't. So the first Omen, on one hand, it's got a lot to build up to because, you know, the original is very famous, it won an Oscar. On the other hand, not a lot of competition for being a good Omen movie, if we're being perfectly frank. Like, it's got a pretty clean slate, all things considered. And, you know, I like this movie less than most people. I was surprised by how many critics just absolutely loved this movie. Like, I watched this movie and I was thinking to myself, there are going to be a certain wave of horror fans who are going to rally behind this thing. And I was disappointed that I wasn't one of them, because while I can appreciate that this movie is unexpectedly gory, like really gross in a way that even like the bigger, grosser Omen movies weren't. I was frustrated that seemed to be mostly all it was. It just feels very... It's a prequel, and it has to lead to what we've seen before, and it feels like it can only go to so many places. And rather than try to tell a truly surprising, interesting, character-driven, like, good story, it's basically we're gonna create a few twists where twists are allowed to exist based on the story that we've already had, which is prequelitis. And then we're going to shove a whole bunch of uncomfortable imagery in there. And that gets you pretty far, but it doesn't work on me. I found it weirdly hollow. But I know you really liked it, so I'm gonna yield the floor and let you sing its praises.
Yeah, I was one of those critics who did really like it. I like this movie a lot, actually. This is a first-time director. Her name is Stevenson.
Arkasha Stevenson.
Arkasha Stevenson, yeah.
Yeah, she did a lot of TV,
Yeah, and this is her first feature, and she has an aesthetic. She has, like, an authorial voice. She's clearly doing this as kind of like a director for hire, doing this horror prequel, but she's not relying on sort of the twists and familiarity with the original Omen, or any kind of association with the Omen. There's a big exposition dump, which feels really awkward unless you're familiar with the original Omen. And there's a few, like, quoted lines of dialogue and, like, a repeated death from the original Omen. And
it's the same thing you've seen before, but it's bigger this time, basically.
Yeah, and those parts are the least interesting. Luckily, those are only fleeting. And I think what's bringing us through is Nell Tiger-Free, the lead actress, who's really, really great. This actually has a really similar premise to Immaculate from a couple weeks ago.
That I couldn't see that young, as well and compare it. So I'm curious how you think they compare. Yeah,
but they're both about young American nuns. In Immaculate, she's already a nun. In this one, she's still a novice. But they both are sent to essentially a convent out in Italy somewhere where they don't really speak the language. And there's some kind of shadowy conspiracy. In fact, both movies feature a scene where the main character looks through a crack in the door and sees something horrible, like somebody being tortured on the other side. And a mother superior appears in the crack and closes the door. That happens in both of these movies. The thing is, Immaculate, I feel like, had really nothing to say. It was more style than anything, and it didn't have the bravery to be really salacious either. It wasn't a grindhouse or wasn't art house. That's how I reviewed it. I feel like Arkasha Stevenson is looking at sort of the Catholic Church as the sort of insidious unit, and they do explain a lot about, like, what's going on with the Antichrist and the Catholic Church and the relationship between those things. But she's also pointing out how grievously horrible the Catholic Church treats women and views women's bodies, and how there's a lot of this notion of women being vessels and ownership of those vessels. Like, all of that is said pretty explicitly throughout. And I think that gives it a little bit of thematic richness. And in addition to all of these, to be quite frank, pretty excellent scares. I think it's really well designed. I think it's really well paced. There's a few images that are just super nightmarish. There's a scene might be a dream sequence where somebody's, like, floating down a hallway, which is just, that was really, really scary.
Yeah. There's a scene in this movie where someone is giving birth. It's earlier in the movie because they're at, like, a convent that does, like, services for people who are, you know, having children out of wedlock.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where someone is giving birth, and I saw this on the Disney lot.
And this is a Disney picture.
This is technically a Disney movie because they own Fox now. And I saw something in that scene, and it didn't, like, terrify me or really, really gross me out, but it's clearly attempting to be extremely extreme for, like, a mainstream kind of horror movie. And there's something just, here's the deal. I agree that I think Arkasha Stevenson is trying to get at some themes about the way that the Catholic Church mistreats women. And, you know, there's a bit where they touch upon, you know, the topic of abortion, which, of course, the Catholic Church is adamantly against. But I find it's not allowed to say very much about those things because of the nature of the plot and what is the only things that are allowed to happen. And I think it's very safe to bring up those topics when the conclusion is foregone and you can't actually have a complicated conversation about it. But, like, I'll say this. Arkasha Stevenson took this work-for-hire gig. This is, on a script level, this is not great. This is kind of feeding you into, okay, we know Damien's going to be conceived. It's going to happen this later in the movie. We just kind of got to get there, and we have to try to surprise you a little bit along the way about exactly the way it happens. I predicted every single thing that was going to happen. And that doesn't make me smart. It just means I was sat in the theater bored a lot of the time.
I'm sorry.
But I will give the movie this as a work-for-hire thing. I think Nell Tiger Free, especially later in the movie where she gets to really genuinely react to what's happening and not just sort of wander around trying to, you know, justify, oh, I saw this really creepy thing, but it's probably fine. Like, once the horror really kicks in, there's a great scene, like, right outside a car where she is giving it her all, and good for her. Great, great, great breakout. Give her more roles. Awesome. And I feel that way about Arkasha Stevenson, too. When she's hamstrung by the way that this movie is, like, permanently attached to these pre-existing films and is only allowed to do so much within that framework, in the way that, like, Rogue One could only do so much because we know those characters aren't allowed to live because they're not in the later movies. Even with those limitations, she pushed as far as she could go. And I think that in the end, while I don't agree with some people that broaching the themes that she broaches in that movie is the same as exploring them in an interesting way, nor do I think that adding all of this really gory gore, like stylish gory gore, I'll give you all of that, I don't think that compensates for the film's flaws. But I do think it shows that she's an interesting filmmaker, that she's a filmmaker whose personality and style can emerge in even like the most studio driven type of project. And I think that, and I was a little surprised actually, considering how good the word of mouth is, the movie didn't do great at the box office. I think that people are going to see this movie and want to give her more work. And I hope they do, because this is definitely a calling card kind of film where it's like, oh my God, who directed that? I want to see what they do next, whether or not I love this. And so I'll give the movie all those things. It just didn't quite do it for me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry it didn't get to you, because I think it's really skilled and good.
I can't help but wonder, like, I seriously, I'm bummed out that I kept trying to go see Immaculate, and we've been having car trouble. It's not a whole thing. I'm not going to get into it, but like, I just don't have the ability to get to the theater as easily as I used to lately. I wasn't able to see it, and I feel weird not seeing it. It's like, hey, I want you to review Armageddon. Did you see Deep Impact? Came out a month ago? No. Okay, well, it's going to be weird that you don't have that frame of reference. and it's a trap, honestly, because in the future, people aren't necessarily going to see them back-to-back like this. Yeah. But today, horror fans got two violent, nunsploitation pregnancy movies back-to-back. They're going to be comparing them, and I don't know which one's better. I really don't. Maybe if I see Immaculate, I'll like this one more because I see what it's doing differently and I'll dig it. Or maybe I'll like Immaculate more. I have no idea. And I'm looking forward to getting to it. I will, of course, when I get the chance, but I feel bad. I feel bummed out about it.
That's
okay.
So sorry.
Okay. So am I.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Vim, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Okay, tell me about, I've seen it, and we'll both review it, but you take all the lead on Monkey Man.
Monkey Man. This is an action picture, co-written and directed by and starring Dev Patel. This was his dream project. He wanted to make a kind of a John Wick style action film, and he is very open that he's kind of knocking off John Wick in terms of like style and violence.
The movie name checks John Wick. They literally say this is the gun John Wick used.
Yeah. It's set in India, and the title Monkey Man refers to the tales of Hanuman, an old myth about a monkey who is cursed by the gods, and they will just hammer and hammer and hammer on Hanuman repeatedly throughout the movie.
Yes.
The movie's about as subtle as a truck. But the plot is something horrible happened to him as a child, and something happened to his mother in his village, and we only get brief flashes, but we know it has something to do with the gangsters that he is seeking to get employment with, and this is going to be his quest to sort of seek revenge. And
yeah.
We also know that he's really cut, and in his spare time, he fights in underground boxing rings, and in these boxing rings, the fighters have to wear masks. They're kind of anonymous. They're just named after animals. And we have a little cameo by Shoto Copley in those scenes.
Mm. He plays the MC, yeah.
Yeah, the kind of the ring announcer.
Yeah.
It takes a little while to get going. Hmm. But I kind of like Dev Patel's style. He is clearly going for a very clunky, traditional... Maybe not traditional, just sort of contemporary action movie style where there's a lot of quick cutting and there's a lot of gritty, breathless close-ups and a lot of handheld camera work. It's not Stead. It's like really a visually busy movie where there's just a lot of movement and jittering and the camera spins around. Like, he's really trying to bring a lot of life and energy just to his camera work.
Yeah.
Let me look up the cinematographer. Sharon Meyer. I don't know the cinematographer's work, unfortunately.
No, not of hand, no, yeah.
Eventually, however, you know, once he, like, starts... All of that stuff is pretty predictable, and it's all not terribly interesting. It's like, okay, he's setting up, he's going to get revenge, he's going to do violent things. And he's Dev Patel, and he's handsome, and he's cut, and he's going to look good doing it. Partway through the movie, there's going to be that point where, like, he tries and he fails and he has to sort of get back on his feet. That's traditional kind of hero's journey stuff.
Yeah, he can't beat the bad guy halfway through the movie. He's got to have some kind of stumbling block that, you know, it's like, oh, maybe I can't do it. No, I can't. Never mind. And then the movie can
go. Yeah, so he has to, like, kind of reconnoiter and reconsider what he's doing and train again and get back in fighting shape. And it's that sequence... where, for at least for me, the movie really started to take off, because he falls in with a group of outcasts. He falls in with a group of trans women who are shunned by society.
Yes.
And they play the tabla for him, and they tell him tales, and they're awesome, and they're, like, divine.
Yeah, they're like holy figures. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And there's a scene where Dev Patel is training, and he's punching a bag of basmati rice. So we're going for every sort of like Indian cliche we can, and he whips his shirt off, and he's really cut. And of course, all the women just go ooh. They kind of like fan themselves a little bit.
Anyone with taste goes ooh at that point.
Well, that's true. And he punches the bag of rice so hard it like flies out and sticks to his sweaty chest. Oh my god, it's like so wonderfully fetishistic.
And you should be mad at him because he's fetishizing himself because he wrote and directed this, but also it's fine. I am totally okay with it. He's doing great.
and of course, in order to train punches, the tabla player is like drumming to the beats he should be punching, and like so the tabla music becomes like part of the violence, and all of these like Indian images and all of these Indian pieces of music and pieces of Indian culture just sort of work their way into the action. So by then, something is kind of synthesizing with Monkey Man that I really, really like. And of course, by the end, we're going to see the holy trans women coming out armed with like blades and wearing masks, also kicking ass. And
you didn't count on my army of badass trans women, did you? And the bad guys are like, we did not. No, that's the whole mask. It's so great. I like this movie a lot. I like many of the same things that you like. I think Dev Patel did not have to incorporate an army of like empathetic, well-realized trans women as like his cavalry charge in this movie. And I think that's really cool. And I appreciate just how much this movie is on the side of outsiders, which is something that I think a lot of movies claim to do, but they're not actually doing. And I think that's great. I think it's really, really wonderful. I think the overall aesthetic of it is just really inky and yet very detailed, and it feels very lived in and that kind of sweaty back of the restaurant kind of way, you know, where we're seeing like all the people. We're not seeing as much of what we would normally see in like a James Bond movie, which is everyone in the front and their fancy gowns enjoying, and we're seeing all the shit people do to keep that running. Yeah. And I think that's a great a look and approach. I think the movie has two big problems. They're not, they don't kill it, but they undermine it a bit. And the big one for me is the action sequences are not as well filmed as I would like. There's a few that really pop. There's a couple bits towards the end. There's a thing Dev Patel does with a knife in an elevator that made the entire audience go, "We ain't seen that before. That was awesome. Thank you for that." Like, there's a few really cool bits, but I get the impression that this was a very run and gun production at times. Like, they're straining against their budget. They might be straining against time. And a lot of the action sequences, even the really intense and theoretically cooler ones, are filmed from so close up sometimes that I have to take the actual fight part of the fight on faith. Like, I guess he's punching somebody. It's pretty, when I see it, it's cool. And most of the time I'm not. And I don't, I feel like that's hiding some limitations of the production. That feels less like a clever design because it doesn't work, and more like we did this in a very run and gun way. It's a good-looking movie, but it's clearly not a super expensive movie. And they made their choices, and I don't think all of them worked, and that's fine. I also think that there is definitely a strange pace to the film, in that the first half, as he's like got a plan, and he's going to infiltrate these people, and these things that he does, it seems like they're incidental, but they pay off later, and then it leads to this one extended action sequence. It feels like that's very calculated. Like, that's a very, it's like a slow burn action movie. We're building to something here. And then when that goes haywire, the movie kind of takes a while to get back on its feet again. And I realize the character does too, and that's kind of the point. But I feel like the pacing falls apart there for a while, and I started getting a little a little sleepy-eyed for a bit there. I'm like, we could probably move on now. Yeah. And
The movie is 121 minutes.
It doesn't need
all that time. I understand why Dev Patel wanted to make it that long, because he had a lot of ideas. Sure. He just wanted to cram a lot of this stuff in here. Y'all wanted to have the low moments where people kind of heal, but also like extended long action sequences. Mm-hmm. And he took the wrong lessons from John Wick, because if you remember the first John Wick, that was a very lean film. It was just a very basic story. Sad man, dog dies, gets revenge. Period. That's it.
Pretty much.
That's the elevator pitch.
There's a few like fun quirks in there, but they stay out of the way of the story.
Yeah.
Like the whole hotel thing, that's fun incidental stuff. It's not the point.
But then, you know, you go to the sequels, they started to get more and more complicated. They were more about the mythos and the secret society of assassins. It's like, no, you're taking the wrong lessons here. I feel like Monkey Man watched like John Wick 3 and 4, like the ones that were way too long, and thought, let's do that a little bit. It's like, no, that's the wrong lesson. You don't need, we're not drawn to these things because they're long and complicated. We like the opposite.
There's a moment in this movie, and again, it calls its shots with John Wick, and it's definitely, I feel like there are moments in this movie where Dev Patel is either auditioning to star as James Bond or auditioning to direct James Bond, and I'm fine with both or either, by the way. I think if you give him more money, this movie becomes even stronger, as opposed to some movies where the other person, some filmmakers wouldn't know what to do with the money. It clearly here, the things that are holding him back are money, and that's not great, but he's he works with it well, and the movie ultimately turns out pretty, pretty good. But what I live for are the moments in this movie where it feels like he's not inspired by the obvious things. And, you know, the subplot with the various trans women, that's definitely one of those things. I also feel like there's a scene towards the end of this movie where the pacing shifts dramatically, and it's like, oh, Dev Patel really likes the movie Belly. Like the Hype Williams movie.
The Hype
Belly.
Williams movie? Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking about
that movie today.
I know he likes that movie because there's a scene, a very memorable scene towards the end of that movie that he's clearly, it seems to me, I'd be surprised if he wasn't a fan. He's doing something dramatically similar as a big climactic scene in the movie Belly. And you know what? More movies should be inspired by that wave of filmmaking, I feel, in the mainstream. And I think that's really, really cool. Yeah, I think it's got some problems, but it's all problems that are come from I had a lot of ideas, I tried really, really hard, and if I had $5 million more dollars, I could have nailed it. And what that says to me is this is a really good movie. It's a little longer than it needs to be. Hmm. Give him more money. Well, let him direct.
More so than The First Omen, I feel like this is a little bit more of a calling card phenomenon where, well, you know, he's sort of establishing his credentials and his skills more than he is trying to make this as best. Like, it feels more like a demo reel.
Well, and it's an interesting demo reel.
Showing what he's capable of rather than what he, and you know, declaring what he wants to do later on. Rather than focusing on this film.
And I think that's really, really great. And I think it's interesting, you know, Jordan Peele is credited as a producer on this. And when Jordan Peele moved to features as a director, he transformed his career through sheer talent and force of will. I was a comedy guy, and now I'm a horror guy. Yeah. And he successfully made that move. And I feel like a lot of actors, when they turn to directing, there's a general tendency for them to make acting showcase movies, and that's
like character pieces.
That's not a rule, but it seems to happen a lot. And I feel like, you know, Dev Patel could have done that, but he clearly wanted to kick ass. Like, he wanted to make a genre film, and he wanted to filter that genre film through his own interests and his own culture. And he successfully did that, and he proved it could work. And he proved that even though, and there's a lot of stuff in this movie that I know I don't understand the full context of.
Yeah.
Because I'm not from that culture. I don't understand the politics of everything going on in India right now. There's stuff that went over my head. But it's still very accessible. He's able to make something that is very distinct and, I don't know, maybe personal is the wrong word, but it's clearly something very individual to him. Like, this is his vision of how these movies can look. And they don't feel like the other movies being made in that realm, and yet they satisfy even if you're not familiar with every single thing he's putting in it. And I think that is a very, very good calling card for a director. And again, I want to see him direct more. And again, he put himself in a tux in this movie on purpose. Make him James Bond. Seriously, make it. He would be great as 007. He'd be fucking great. I would kill for it. Or at the very least, make him the villain and let him direct. That's I'm fine with that.
Yeah. If we do need to keep on with the James Bond thing, then sure, why not?
Yeah. It's the whisper heard most often. They're like, oh, what if this was like, and I'm like, if it is, it's great. But honestly, just keep doing your own original shit, man. I mean, this is clearly got some influences from various, you know, underground street fight movies and revenge thrillers, but it's your own thing. Keep doing it. You don't have to go into a franchise. I realize I fell into that trap. Oh, what a cool movie from a first-time director. What franchise should they do? I just did that by accident. I really didn't mean that, but also, yeah, I kind of do, actually. I want to see this kind of filmmaking in the mainstream more, because the mainstream has gotten, and it always is, but like, it's really generic a lot of the time. And this kind of movie, whether it's a huge hit or it's not, it's doing okay, but like, I feel like this is the kind of movie that people are going to, you know, a lot of people are going to see it now. It won't make $200 million or something like that, but it'll do fine. But over time, people are going to watch this and go, I want to make more movies like that. Like, more movies need to have this vibe. More movies need to feel this distinct, even in the formulaic action realm.
Yeah.
And I feel like that it could end up being an influential movie if the right people watch it and act on it. So I hope they do. All right. And then the last movie.
And that's all I saw. I'd like to hear about The People's Joker, because I really wanted to see this.
I love this movie. I love this movie a lot. This movie, by the way, I interviewed on this podcast the writer, director, editor, and star, well, co-writer, but they did all the other stuff, of this movie, Vera Drew, in an hour-long podcast. We haven't done filmmaker interviews since the old days of the B-Movies podcast, and we're trying to bring that back. So I don't know how often we're going to be able to do it, but we're putting out a lot of feelers, and hopefully we'll be able to do more soon. But what a great way to start. So The People's Joker is a very interesting project. It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival about a year and a half ago. And it was immediately met with a letter from Warner Brothers saying, hey now, it wasn't technically a cease and desist or like a takedown letter. But it was, we got our eye on this. We're not entirely sure this is okay. What Vera Drew did, and Vera Drew is a trans woman, an editor, a comedian. They did a project in which they took elements from the Batman comics, specifically relating to the Joker, the mm-hmm. Todd Phillips movie, but also elements of the Jared Leto version and other versions as well. And instead of telling a Joker movie, they told their own life story by altering and adapting pop culture iconography so that instead of being this incredibly generic, you know, mainstream four quadrant, anyone can kind of relate to this thing, they took all of these things that were so used to being flattened out and made them deeply specific and highly personal. It is... I'm struggling to think of another movie in the superhero genre, adaptation or otherwise, that felt like such a personal statement.
Mm-hmm.
At least one respectable film critic has called this the best superhero movie ever just for that reason. And I think there's a good argument for that. I really, really do. It is a very low-budget production. It is protected under parody rules. There's a big, long, like, opening of South Park legalese credit scroll basically saying we're allowed to do this, Warner Brothers, chill the fuck out. But it takes place in Gotham City kind of post The Dark Knight Returns, so it's a little dystopian. Okay. It's very dystopian. And our main character is grows up as a kid from Smallville with an emotionally abusive mother, and when her mother finds out she's trans, she takes the Joker to see Dr. Jonathan Crane, the Scarecrow, who prescribes an antidepressant called Smilex gas. Now, okay. This isn't genius, but you see how it is like taking stuff that we are familiar with and creating a more personal individual context. So this is what happens when your parents don't understand you, and rather than try to understand you, they decide to change you. And in this case, they do it
back to what they were used to. Yeah,
exactly. And they because it's more convenient. There's a great bit where the kid, like the kid's saying, like, I don't want to go on drugs. I promise I'll never tell you when I'm sad ever again. And that's a very heartbreaking line. But the kid grows up learning to hide their queerness under a veil of comedy. And this makes them want to pursue a career in comedy. But in this dystopian hellscape, comedy is illegal unless it's on Saturday Night Live. Like it's not called Saturday Night Live, but it is run by Lorne Michaels. And Maria Bamford plays Lorne Michaels, but it's a cartoon character, literally.
Maria Bamford plays Lorne Michaels.
I know, it's great. And so our Joker tries to go into Saturday Night Live. It's not working. They end up meeting the Penguin. Whose stand-up act is all fish-related humor. One of the best lines in the movie is when he says, it's an aquatic taste.
Oh my God.
That's a good line. I'm sorry. See, like, Burgess Meredith would eat that line. He would just devour it, and you would love it. They decide, since they can't do comedy, their comedy is, like, literally trying to exclude them from mainstream, to create anti-comedy. And we'll call it anti-comedy. And it'll be, like, challenging the norms of what comedy is supposed to be. And in the process of that, they end up with an entire, like, comedy troupe comprised of the various villains from the Batman universe who no place for them. There's no place for them here. They're queer. They're outsiders. They're monsters in some cases, literally, like, you know. And over the course of it, our character discovers that she's trans. She meets the Joker. It's the Jared Leto version of the Joker. There's some interesting twists with that character that add a lot of unexpected sort of depth to it, but I won't ruin that. And we talked about this a lot when we reviewed the Adam West Batman TV series on our Patreon. But if you're saying that the Batman villains sort of represent chaos, well, you have to ask yourself what is order in this universe? And if the order that this universe offers is oppressive, then chaos is a form of heroism, or at the very least, it is understandable rebellion. So becoming a villain in this universe and pursuing comedy and pursuing art that is outside the norm is frightening to some people, heroic in other contexts, and the film explores how the villains can be the heroes and the heroes can be the villains depending on what minute of the day we're looking at them. And there's an unusual moral and ethical complexity to it. It is incredibly deeply personal, and there's a lot of just really wonderful, heartbreaking, like, relationship drama between the Joker and the other Joker. And it ends up being kind of, like, literally transcendent in a way, Don't Ruin. It's a mixed-media project. A lot of it was filmed in front of a green screen. There's a lot of human actors, and they're interacting with animated actors, and the animation is in a variety of styles, ranging from this looks like the video game Doom to this looks like kind of, like, straight out of, like, TV Funhouse. Some of it is, like, literally just walking in and out of a painting. Some of it is puppetry. It's incredibly alive with inspiration, and everything that it takes as inspiration, it transforms, which it should. And it's such a wonderful thing to be able to say, I saw a Batman movie that I am more likely to compare to Kenneth Anger than I am to any other superhero movie on the market.
Yeah.
Like I'm like, when you think about the way that, like, Scorpio Rising took familiar, popular hit tunes, like stuff that we sort of accepted as mainstream and sort of solidifying sort of the mainstream norm, but by recontextualizing them into a queer biker gang narrative, we see just how, like, the way that our mainstream, bland, popular culture either hides, like, on purpose, the real humanity and the real everyone who doesn't necessarily fit under that banner, and the way that people who fit under that banner have to appropriate the mainstream because there's so little other art for them.
And and that's the vibe I get. Sadly, I didn't see this movie. I really wanted to see this movie because I did get that kind of Kenneth Anger vibe, this idea that we're going to take literal popular culture. We're going to use the names Batman and the Joker, but we are going to remix it to our liking. And I feel like the last decade has been trying to recreate a specific author's version of a popular culture character. This is Stan Lee's version of Spider-Man.
This is Frank Miller's Batman, etc.
These characters are like 80 years old, though. They're like part of the popular cult gestalt, and we're ready to stop worshiping at the commercial altar long enough to get these explosions of reinterpretation, this and I hate to keep on leaning on the phrase, but, you know, culture jamming.
Yeah.
This idea that we're going to take the Joker and turn it into our queer version of the Joker. Gosh, it looks so fascinating. I really love that idea.
Yeah.
And I also like that they were permitted to use the actual names. It's great to see something try to be actually subversive again. Thinking about last year, there was a really terrible, terrible movie that came out last year called Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey.
And I've talked
about how much I hate that movie. It's terrible. But I appreciate its existence immensely because they're finally trying to filth up and reinterpret something that has long been held by a family-friendly mainstream studio.
I appreciate that they're
continuing to do that with these pop culture figures that were held in such almost like secular holiness in terms of like their commercial viability, and how we can finally just pee on them.
I feel like that's a good comparison actually, because although Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey waited until that was in the public domain, they're still taking something that has been extremely corporatized and controlled for as long as we can remember and subverting it. And while that movie does it to no meaningful end other than to do it, which itself is a form of rebellion.
Yeah.
You know, not all punk rock is good punk rock, but all punk rock is punk rock. I will take it, like, on print, like the true meaning of punk rock, not just we had loud guitars, but, like, actually we are fighting against the system and trying to stand outside of it. That is a noble endeavor, I think, for any artist. And if you succeed in a meaningful way, I think you can achieve genuine greatness. I think the Evil's Joker does that. But even if you don't succeed in a meaningful way, as long as you try, that's better than not having that out there, I think.
Yeah,
it's better to have a bunch of failed experiments of people trying to undermine the most popular, the popular culture, the four quadrant generic popular culture. We want to undermine that, and we won't always do it great, but we should always be doing it. And I feel like this is an exciting time because so many of these corporate properties are fizzling out. Like, they're dying down. Some of them are still making money. Some of them always will. But interest in the most sort of conventional version of them is waning. And now is the time to play.
Yeah.
To actually try different weird things. They maybe don't even work, but it will try them. And that's how we get interesting art back. I mean, obviously we want it just to have, you know, nothing to do with that, just tell great art. But if we have all this stuff that is just being shoved down our throat, this is what your art is, these are your myths. Like, I'm tired of people telling me that, like, superhero movies are myths. Like, I don't believe in Batman. Like, myth started out as religion. Okay? And if you want these to be, and I talked about this with Vera Drew, if you want superheroes to be our myths, then they need to be ours. And we need to be able to make them mean what we want them to mean for our own lives instead of just consuming them, because that's not what myths are.
Well, that's always been an issue I've had with, you know, the argument that superheroes are like modern Greek gods. No, the gods were worshipped. That was a theology for the ancient Greeks. You know, they represented important facets of everyday life in ancient Greece. Superheroes aren't that. They might in sort of a storytelling way, but they're owned by companies. They're not holy figures. They're not meant to be worshipped.
It's
until we can take them back and make them the people's, as in the people's Joker, then these things are going to have lost their meaning.
Yeah.
They're just commercial enterprises now. And I am so glad, because I sense we're at the end of that. We just lived through like at least a 10-year period, more like 15, where it was just commercial ascendancy. We were only worshiping the property.
Yeah.
And we're finally coming to a point where somebody can make and release something like the People's Joker. That not just pleases me, it makes me relieved. We had like little hints of it throughout. Like, I feel like Deadpool was a really great life preserver for a while, yeah, because that was irreverent and filthy, and it came out of the studio system.
Mm-hmm. And the studio didn't want it. Don't forget that. Like, the only reason they made Deadpool was because they filmed like a test reel. The studio didn't want to make it, and then someone who has never admitted who they are leaked it online, and people were like, oh, we actually want this, and then the studio was forced into it. Deadpool, we think, oh, Deadpool is going to be this huge Marvel movie. Studios did not want something that odd.
Yeah.
They didn't think that that was a good idea. They were wrong, but they tried to keep it down. Yeah.
We're finally at a point where we can take it back. Is it me or are movies good again?
I think where we're at is an interesting inflection point for the industry, and the industry finds something that works, and then they'll make it until it doesn't. They will drive it into the ground. I'm actually amazed this particular wave rode as high for as long as it did without having more than the occasional like blip unsuccessful movie, but like,
yeah,
we're actually trending downward now, and I think that's very, very, very frightening, I'm sure, for a lot of people in the industry who thought that at the very least this was a sure bet,
like in perpetuity. They could, yeah, just make these things permanent parts, yeah, of the pop landscape, not even considering that people wouldn't want to see that forever.
And that's one of the great fallacies of, like, frankly, I think the American point of view, but like especially our version of capitalism, we're incredibly short-sighted. We think about what's immediately right in front of us. What immediate gain can we have when we never think about the big picture? And they had no plan for what happened when this particular formula stopped being as effective.
Yeah.
And that is, I'm sure, very, very frightening to a lot of studio heads and probably a lot of people in the industry who were relying on this as for their bread and butter. But for people who just like art, and, you know, in this particular medium, which, because it's so expensive, is still dominated by these big studios, that's the most exciting time, because now they're trying to find the new formula and they're actually going to try things. And this isn't even them. This is them being forced to admit, technically, you're allowed to do this.
Yeah.
And so someone just made something using all of their archetypes and did something so much more interesting and personal. And yeah, it's cheap and shabby. And no one's going to pretend it's not. But that's part of the fun of it. That's part of what makes it feel like... It feels like if an actual supervillain existed, this is the kind of... And not like a Lex Luthor actually working from within, going to be president someday and destroy us all, but like... The people wearing weird fetish outfits who have a very specific kink and just keep telling riddles, like, this is the movie they make. And it's gonna feel like a breath of fresh air. It's gonna feel dangerous. And that is way more exciting as art. Infinitely more exciting as art. And that's a great feeling. And I'm actually like almost... I'm actually a little surprised at just how good the reviews are. Like, I'm pretty sure this has like one of the highest scores on Rotten Tomatoes of any movie about DC Comics characters. And that makes me so fucking happy. No, I love this movie to pieces. Again, it's a little shabby, and I think it's maybe not as funny as it thinks it is, but it's intelligent and it's emotional. It's transformative. We need more of this. This is really important, and it's so damn good. And I love it to pieces, and please see it if you haven't already, and especially if you've seen it, because we talk about stuff that happens in the movie, but we try not to go into extreme spoiler territory. But check out, if this interests you, please check out like one or two podcasts back in our main timeline feed. I did an hour-long interview with Vera Drew, the creator of The People's Joker. It was a great conversation. I'm very grateful to them for coming on the show, and... yeah, hopefully we can do more of that. But anyway, that is it for our new movie reviews for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us, as always, because we thank you every time, because you're great. But it's time to review our movies on the critically acclaimed scale. Our scale ranges from C minus, those are below average movies, those are movies we don't recommend, to C, those are average movies, those are movies that they're okay. You know, some people will like them more than others, but yeah, they're fine. And then there are C plus movies, and those movies are above average, and that's the highest recommendation we can give. We genuinely think those are good movies. On that scale, I'm giving The People's Joker a big old C plus. Whatever minor limitations there were in the production, they actually fueled the creativity of the filmmaker and made the movie more interesting and gave it more depth. And I think that's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible. It's definitely one of the best movies ever made with these characters in it. It's, you got to see it. I hope you love it as much as I did. Monkey Man.
Because it's so long and because it's kind of loose and a little bit, clearly it's like a filmmaker trying to put together their aesthetic and put together what they're going to be all about. It doesn't really work 100%. I think what does work is amazing. I'm going to give it a low C plus. Like, okay. I think it's, all right. I think all of the stuff that works is really, really astonishing. And I love the army of trans women with scythes. Like, yeah. That's getting it a lot of points.
I really thought you were leading up to a high C there, but it's a low C plus, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm same. Low C plus. Like, it's definitely, much like The People's Joker, you're taking something that, Dev Patel is taking something that is, there's a formula to it, a certain type of action movie, and trying to make it entirely his own. And I think in attempting to make something that could stack up in terms of production quality, production scope to the movies that he's emulating, he bit off a little bit more than he could chew, and the movie sometimes can't live up to that sense of scale or doesn't get necessarily the coverage it needs to make those action sequences really sing. But that doesn't undermine the movie, and it does feel like a particular, interesting, personal version of this kind of action movie made by someone with a lot of talent who I think needs to be nurtured, but I'm looking forward to what else he does. All right. The First Omen. I appreciate that it's got some prequelitis. It can only do so much. There are certain things that it has to do, and that Arkasha Stevenson is trying to use that framework to shove in as much interesting shit as she possibly can. But I think it's a bit of a losing battle. So I'm going to give it a C. Because it's definitely not a wash. There's definitely a lot of interesting imagery in it. It's not, I wouldn't call it a bad movie, but for me, it's too much of a mixed bag. I don't think the extreme horror, and violence entirely compensates for its deficiencies as a story, but they definitely don't hurt it. They definitely help. So I'd say it averages out to a C.
I give it a big C plus. I really loved it. You can see my name on the posters. They're actually quoting my review. I mean, on the
posters,
one.
Really? That's awesome. That's fun.
Well, you can look online. You can see my name on certain like online ads, and I think they might even put it on the video box. Of course, I like it, and I'm okay with that because I really like the movie. I think it's really genuinely scary, which I can't say about a lot of horror movies. Mm-hmm. I think the image and the style is really striking. I think the pacing is and editing are perfect. I really like the performances, and I like that it is delving into an admittedly kind of schlocky 70s satanic thriller. Because the original Omen wasn't nearly as classy as something like The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby. This was like the pulp version of that. Huge, huge hit, but not a lot to say. And I feel like this film is exploring that a little bit better. I don't think it felt like, it didn't feel like a foregone conclusion to me. I didn't have the story issues that you do, because I think it was about this character and her journey, and it didn't necessarily even need to connect to the Omen. Its connections to the Omen were present, but they weren't required to enjoy the film. So I
would dispute.
I think
that,
it's really, really great. I think it's just a good, solid horror flex. I'm going to give it a C plus.
I would dispute what you just said about the way it connects or doesn't connect to the Omen, but I can't go into detail without going into big spoilers. Okay. But I do have a rationale for why I don't think that entirely works. But I will say this: I'm happy you like it so much, and I feel like there's some people don't understand like what it means to be quoted as a film critic. It's somebody like, hey, congratulations. Like I just wrote a review and they quoted it. Like I put my name on it. You can quote that. That's fine. But it is nice when something that we're really passionate about and really love, and when our appreciation for that can help people find that movie, whether it's quoted or just people read the review. That is one of the big reasons why we do what we do. So I'm glad that this movie that you really like, people are hopefully see it through your lens, because you liked it more than I do. You got a better movie out of this than I did. Good for you.
I enjoyed myself. I was I was startled at how much I enjoyed the movie. I really, really loved it.
All right. And then lastly, Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. I'm giving this a big old C+. It's silly. It's ridiculous, but it is exactly the kind of silly and ridiculous it is trying to be. It doesn't undermine that. There's no depth to it, but it's not aiming for it, so I can't really give it any demerits. It's just awesome, ridiculous pop art, and I don't think it's hurting anyone in doing that. I think it's actually the fun, harmless kind of slick silliness that, honestly, bless them, I'm glad they're able to get it out there.
It's a C+, but it's a C+ written in Comic Sans. Like, it's...
Fair enough.
Like this is a goofball of a film, and I really enjoyed it. But it's just the empty-headed, kid-friendly Saturday morning, too much sugar on Saturday morning kind of entertainment. And I'm okay with that. There's a place for that.
Yeah.
There's a certain integrity to that.
Yeah. Okay. So that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening once again. We'll be back next time with reviews of Civil War. And the new spider movie, spider horror movie, actually, Sting. And other things as well. Keep on listening. We really appreciate it. Please subscribe if you haven't already. That really, really helps. Please leave us a review if you haven't. That really, really helps us boost up the algorithm. I know we said that every week. We cannot understate that or overstate that. I don't know. One of those. We need to say it a lot, so because it really is important. Yeah. And if you can afford to help the show monetarily, we're incredibly grateful to everyone who does. We could not do this without the people who are helping us out on Patreon. It wouldn't be possible to spend the amount of time that we spend doing not just this podcast, but our army of podcasts that we have, not just on this channel, but on the Patreon page, where we're reviewing every single Star Trek ever, where we're reviewing every movie ever nominated for Best Picture. We just did a feature-length commentary track to Highlander 2: The Quickening.
Because we don't do commentaries for good movies. No, we do. It's just,
next time we literally told our patrons, make it hurt. And so, like, all of the options for the next commentary track are not just like, oh, this is bad in a Hollywood way, but like, hey, did you ever see Nuki? Did you ever see Things? Like, we want to actually experience physical pain watching the movie, and we will do it. So these are things that only our patrons get. So thank you to all of our patrons. We hope you're enjoying the stuff. And of course, we're on social media at Critic Acclaim. I'm Matt William Bibbiani.
I'm Matt Whitney Seibold.
We have a letters podcast, which we don't do as often as we should, but we'll try to do one next week, called We've Got Mail. If you want to email us, ask us questions, take us to task for things, do you disagree with our reviews, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, please tell them what our P.O. Box is.
Yeah, send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And until next time, please, please, please don't forget that everyone, including you, is a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video, find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.